It is Thursday, January 2nd, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Timothy Dennis.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Katie Henriksen.
Jackie Froelich.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And we continue with some of our favorite stories, features, and interviews from 2013. And you can't have a favorite show unless you talk about grasshoppers. I just made that up, but we're not going to have a favorite show this week without grasshoppers.
No, definitely not. Dr. Donald Steinkraus comes in and speaks with me once a month. This all started actually in the winter fall of 2012. He's an entomologist at the University of Arkansas, and I went and interviewed him about what bees do during the winter. And I enjoyed that conversation with him so much that I asked him if he'd be willing to come in every month and talk about insects. And sometimes, you know, at first I thought we might be scrambling for topics, but sometimes he has ideas and sometimes I have ideas. One of my favorites actually was insects in movies. He came in and talked about, you know, the roles that insects play in various movies. And he was in this month, and I asked him what his favorite story was that we did this year. And he said when we went grasshopper hunting out on his land. So here's that story. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas. On a hot afternoon last week, I spent some time as an entomologist. Our Ozarks at Large insect expert, Dr. Donald Steinkraus, took me to a field on Owl Holler Road near West Fork to go grasshopper hunting. Luckily, Dr. Steinkraus brought our tools.
This is the old-time classic tool of an entomologist, an insect net. And this is what you call a sweep net. It's kind of durable and tough, and you can sweep it through vegetation and collect the insects which are in the vegetation. This one is a little bit sort of a hybrid. It's got a clear area so you can see what you've caught in the bottom. But these are a classic tool. But anyway, so the classic image of a nerd is sort of running around with a net, right?
Right.
And you're going to have to run around with a net, too.
Okay.
Okay.
The way you catch insects is to sweep the net with some force through the grass. Dr. Steinkraus took the first sweep at it to demonstrate.
So this is Johnson grass, an invasive non-native species of grass. So I guess we'll sweep through here and see if we can catch anything. We might not.
So just go back and forth. And then...
Okay, already you can see a whole lot of Orthoptera. These are little grasshopper, or I'm not sure what they are yet because they're jumping so much, but we'll capture some and look at them more closely.
As Dr. Steinkraus mentioned, grasshoppers are in the order Orthoptera, shared with crickets and katydids. The grasshoppers are in the family Acridata and are characterized by having short antennae. As we walk through the grass trying to catch the grasshoppers, they jump up into the air and then land back down and burrow under the grass. In order to look at them more closely, we needed some more tools.
I brought a hand lens, too, because sometimes you have to look at small features on an insect to identify it and get it closer to what you think it is. And the last thing I have is a bucket that we can sweep net some of these and dump our net material into the bucket and see what we got.
Because there are so many different insects in the country, around 300 different species of grasshoppers, with about 30 native to Arkansas, entomologists need a key to identify them. So Dr. Steinkraus also brought along a book. Entomologists are very into books.
This is an absolutely excellent book on grasshoppers and katydids and crickets of the U.S. by John Caponera. It's really a top-notch book, because I'm not an expert on grasshoppers, though I would like to be.
So once we sweep the grass, dump our catch into the bucket, Dr. Steinkraus pulls out a grasshopper, and we begin to identify it by looking closely at its characteristics and comparing them to images and descriptions in the book.
Eastern Myrmia.
Oh, yeah. Here's the slant-faced ones.
Eastern Myrmia.
I think... Yeah, you think it's Eastern Myrmia?
Maybe.
This one here?
It kind of has the stripe along its face.
Or how about this one here, the clipped wing? Here's what we have to do now. We need to... Oh. It's awfully pretty, this one is. We need to go back here.
This was a slant-faced grasshopper with lovely green and tan colors. In the hand, beautiful. But in the grass, among the live green blades and dry tan blades, it really blended in. Dr. Steinkraus calls this camouflage crypsis. we determine that it is the handsome grasshopper. Most grasshoppers have one generation per year, and the overwintering stage is the eggs, usually in soil or in plant material. The nymphs hatch out in the early spring or summer. We also found some nymphs.
Grasshoppers have incomplete metamorphosis. They have what we call nymphs, and the nymphs look a lot like the adult, except for they're smaller and their wings aren't as well developed. So these little nymphs are very abundant in this grass, and they can't fly yet because their wings aren't fully developed, but they'll molt and grow, and then by maybe September they'll be mature and then they'd be big.
He mentioned flying and likens grasshoppers to birds. There are some species that have very colorful wings and blues, yellows, oranges, and reds that can be seen as they jump from the grass and fly back down. I caught one with red wings, though carrying a recorder made it difficult to catch, so I had to put my microphone down as I swept the grass. This guy was what I call a big daddy.
Yep, Christina caught a monster. It's the biggest one yet today, right?
Yes. My entomologist skills are improving.
Yeah, she went off on her own and she caught it. She's better off without me. This is a big, strong, hefty guy, isn't he?
It's big.
And it's got pretty bands on its wings, little spots. It's got some little stripes on its femur.
It's a big head.
It's got a big head, doesn't it? Look, he's trying to spit up on me. I don't want to hurt him, though. Let's see if we can get his wings out. He doesn't like that at all. I don't want to hurt him. Look at that beautiful red wing. Isn't that a pretty thing?
Wow, yeah.
So you don't think of grasshoppers as being beautiful, but just as pretty as a bird, a cardinal or something. Okay, well, we can try to identify it.
We determine that this large gray and brown band-winged grasshopper with large dark spots on its forewings and bright orange or rose-colored wings is a Para delphora phenocoptera. Please excuse my pronunciation. With many of these insects, the males make noises to attract females. These are called calling songs. A male uses his song to advertise to females his species, location, sexual readiness, and quality as a mate. Most of these songs are produced by stridulation, rubbing two parts of the body together, such as the forewing rubbing against the hind wing, or the femur against the forewing. This is mainly in crickets and katydids, though. The band-winged grasshoppers use crepitation, or wing snapping, to produce sounds while flying. This is sort of like a sail on a sailboat snapping in the wind.
So how do they hop, do you think?
With those big back legs.
Yeah, so they have this really big femur. It's full of muscles. Their tibia is really narrow. It's like on a horse, like, you know, a racehorse. They got a thin little, you know, tibia or foreleg, and they can move it fast with this. They have like a special spring mechanism in their legs for hopping. So they got a bunch of defenses.
Most of these grasshoppers will lay their eggs and die by late fall. Last week, we also caught a differential grasshopper, a dark one with a herringbone black mark on its femur. In addition, a Kiowa rangeland grasshopper, one with a pale yellow band on its hind wings. Not a grasshopper, but we did catch a round-tipped conehead, a katydid, which is responsible for the nightly sounds you hear here in Arkansas. During the day, though, you're listening to cicadas.
That's from 2013. This is another program devoted to our favorite interviews, features, and stories that we have had on Ozarks at Large the previous 12 months. Let's move from grasshoppers that were real to bugs that are not quite real. Timothy Dennis?
Yes, this was actually a really fun story. I learned through, I forget where I learned it, but I learned that there was an artist that the city of Fayetteville had commissioned to sort of, not necessarily disguise, but dress up some of the utility boxes around the square. His name is Jason Jones, and he took a creative approach to dressing up these utility boxes. He decided to paint garden variety bugs on them to make them blend into the surroundings. And so on a late spring day, I walked up to the Fayetteville Square and talked with him about the murals. If you've been to the Fayetteville Farmers Market or otherwise been on the downtown square in the past few weeks, you've probably noticed a few new critters inhabiting the gardens around the old post office. These critters don't crawl, but rather protect the visual serenity of the space. Since late last month, artist Jason Jones has been painting pictures of bugs on the electrical boxes in the garden. When I met up with Jones at about midday, he was putting some additional touches onto a lace wing.
This one, I'm just kind of putting some highlights and kind of darkening some shadows on it. Basically, this one's almost finished. I'll come back after it cures a little bit, and then I'll put a clear coat, like a UV protective clear coat. So it should last.
The lace wing is just the latest denizen to join the painted populace of the downtown square.
So that one's the lace wing. I don't know how garden friendly. There's a, I guess you can see it better from around the corner. There's a Luna moth, which they're just really pretty.
Right.
So I don't know how protective of gardens they are. And then around the corner over here, there's a monarch butterfly. And I did a ladybug. I guess they're very garden friendly. They eat the bad insects.
Jones says he's painted bugs on 6 of the electrical boxes so far, but he says there is space for additional bugs to be painted in the garden.
And I'm not sure how many more they'll keep going with. I know there's several more electrical boxes. This is kind of just phase one, what I'm doing now. I'm going to do some more sketches, and they'll look at them and approve them, and then kind of go from there.
Jones says that with several more boxes that could be painted, there's room for about 6 or 7 more bugs in the gardens. But Jones isn't doing this public art project on his own. Fayetteville's Parks and Recreation Department commissioned him to work his magic on the utility boxes in an effort to partially mask their appearance amid the flowers and other landscaping around the square. Roxanne Worthy, one of the city's horticulturists, told me late last year that she originally got the idea for the murals on one of her travels.
I was in Colorado a couple years ago, up around the Vail area, and came across some that had been painted and thought it was a great, you know, idea to cover up something that's usually pretty ugly looking. And so we've had a picture that I took of it sitting on our desk for a while, and just finally got time to pursue it and find somebody who could do some drawings on the boxes for us, some painting.
So Worthy contracted Jones after being impressed with a sign he painted for the Kids Crop Gardens at the Yvonne Richardson Community Center and the poster he created for last year's Block Street Block Party. The Parks and Recreation Department hired Jones to come up with some designs. As far as what bugs he has chosen to paint, Jones says he didn't turn to professional sources for his research.
I just looked online and tried to see what bugs were good for gardens. So, yeah, I probably need to find an entomologist to help me. Because I know there's, like, praying mantis and... I'll probably do that on one, and then I'll have some bees on some others. After that, I'll have to do some more research.
But he says that much of his inspiration for the project came from the gardens themselves.
I'm a gardener myself. You know, I have a pretty big garden. So I guess it kind of comes from that. I knew, you know, I had a little bit of an idea of the insects that, you know, would work well. So kind of spurred out of that.
Jones says that he deliberately painted a particular pair of the beneficial bugs on opposing sides of one box to serve as an educational lesson.
Just because some people don't realize that caterpillar turns into the butterfly, and someone actually came along while I was painting it and said, yeah, they didn't realize they've actually killed the caterpillars, you know, before, when actually, you know, they don't hurt the garden at all.
Though this isn't his first outdoor art project, Jones says that he has had plenty of visitors while working on the project.
This spot particular, I've been visited by a lot of real bugs as I've gone. So, yeah, the little box with the lunar moth, there's a red wasp that lives in there. And then I've just had, you know, because they're all attracted to the flowers and everything here in the surroundings. So, yeah, that's been a little different. But they've all been friendly, and so it's worked out fine.
But the work has been attracting the attention of more than just the resident wasps and other bugs in the garden. Jones says he has been approached about doing a similar project at Washington Elementary School.
They have kind of this awkward little courtyard area with big electrical boxes, and then there's 2 kind of stuccoed walls. And they want basically the same thing. They're going to put in some nice plants and kind of fix it up. the children can't go in this little area, so they're just going to make it look nice. And then I'm going to do two walls, murals, basically giant bugs, and then paint the electrical boxes.
So the next time you're walking around town and hear the hum of an electrical box, you might just see one of Jones's painted bugs buzzing along as if it were a real one.
That's from earlier this year on Ozarks Large. This is a special edition of Ozarks where we talk about some of our favorite stories from 2013. All right, we've caught some grasshoppers. We've seen some utility boxes painted. But neither of those are as unusual as paw painters, Jacqueline Froelich.
I had to fight with you on this one because I know you have dibs on Turpentine Creek.
Yes.
Creatures. You'd
yes.
like to go cover them.
I do.
And you let me go there because I'd heard that they are looking for novel ways to earn money, and they have found it. They have struck gold. They've commissioned their inmates to produce fine pieces of art. And I went to the rescue last winter to hook up with refuge curator Kelly Jo Carroll, and she took us to meet a grizzly bear who literally relishes his paintings,
bam,
a tiger
bam.
Who makes whisker art, a lion who's a claw artist, and an abstract tongue impressionist. It was awesome. African lions carol to each other this cold, sunny afternoon, claiming their stake on Turpentine Creek Wildlife Refuge. They share their quarters with 117 tigers, cougars, leopards, and bobcats. Nearby, an array of striped Bengal tigers lazily doze in their dens. But one, named Ty, suddenly rouses as refuge staff Kelly Jo Carroll approaches his cage, making chuffing sounds, showing him a white canvas. The 14-year-old tiger gracefully jumps off his perch and prowls towards her, chuffing back. As Ty watches, Kelly Jo drips and swirls turquoise, yellow, and aqua blue non-toxic paint over the canvas, lays it on the ground, then using a rebar hook, pushes it partially into the cage. Ty grabs it with one large orange paw and starts to lick.
You're doing a good job. Yeah, look at that face.
Ty uses his rough tongue to mix the thick puddles of paint into dense waves and swirls. Kelly Jo assists, turning the canvas this way and that. Suddenly, he stops and looks up. He's done.
Good job, Ty.
You did a good job. Good boy. Are you done? Is that it? Do you guys like it? You did a good job.
Kelly Jo Carroll from Buffalo, New York, is one of more than 300 college students who've completed a six-month internship at this refuge. But she, like the tigers, has taken a permanent position. Rain's been watching us the whole time. She's right next door. We see if she's in the mood to paint. Not.
Come on, Belle. Come here. Come on. You want to paint today or not?
Oh, yeah.
We leave the grumpy tiger to her nap in search of another artist. Staff don't enter any of the 30 by 50 foot enclosures unless the big cats are safely sequestered. The art making is always facilitated from outside the cages. The only real hazard to watch for is when a cat turns around and lifts a tail. Speaking of scents, canvases are sprayed with a fruit or floral fragrance, and some of the fussier cats prefer designer name perfumes.
They love any kind of new scent. They'll come and investigate it. They have an organ in the roof of their mouth called the Jacobson's organ, and they'll do this kind of funny looking face called a stinky face. We call it a stinky face, but they're trying to get the chemical receptors to the roof of their mouth. So they love smelling any kind of new scent.
In the wild, large cats rely on their extraordinary sense of smell to hunt, procreate, or attract predators. But imagine what a spritz of herbal catnip might create. We check out one more artist, Bam Bam, a gymammoth grizzly bear who's using a brown and pink palette today.
Hey, sneaky bear, look at you.
Starting to close his eyes.
He's like, ooh, chocolate, raspberry.
Bam Bam makes some final touches to the canvas using his long black tongue.
He's getting a little bit better, but he's also a big licker. So sometimes you look at the canvas and you're missing most of the paint. So it's like a very like watercolor kind of artwork. So he's probably our best yet.
Unlike the tigers, whose muzzles are smeared with paint afterward, the grizzly is very neat. Lions also paint, but not today. Something's up with them.
Sometimes they'll tell each other before a storm comes. Even if we actually have a vet come, they'll warn each other that a vet's coming and hide in their dens. So they'll say all sorts of things. Right now they're probably talking about, does anyone see the food? How much longer till supper time?
The animals are fed once a day, late afternoon, but are continually enriched.
Every day the interns go around and they'll give them enrichment throughout the day. Sometimes it's cardboard boxes with hay in there, or cedar, or a burlap sack with some sort of grass or something inside that they can rip open and use their nails and teeth like it was a prey. And on their birthdays, they all get something. Sometimes interns will make some sort of meatsicle or a fruitsicle for our bear in the summer months. And then in the winter, they'll get like presents that are wrapped and there'll be something inside and the cats will rip them open, or some sort of big cardboard animal that's in their habitat and they go and pounce on it. So it's really cute seeing what the interns will come up with for enrichment.
The cages are also equipped with bowling balls and pins and other toys to keep the cats interested and exercised. Turpentine Creek, established in 1995, is now filled with clean, spacious enclosures, one quarter concrete, the rest grassland habitat. But of an estimated 60 big cat sanctuaries nationwide, only one big cat rescue in Tampa, Florida, creates and markets so-called paw paintings. Last year, Turpentine Creek, which has been doing paw paintings for about a year, auctioned a dozen original big cat artworks, raising several thousand dollars. $15 reproductions are also for sale in the gift shop, with artists' bios attached.
A lot of these artworks are very original, like right over here for B.B. King, you can see his paw prints that go across the canvas. Some of them you can actually see nail marks or teeth marks or holes in it and things like that. Some of them really get into the painting. Sometimes you'll have fur on the paintings as well.
Adding exciting value to the abstract expressionist works, proceeds go towards swimming pools and misters to keep cats cool in the summer, and cozy blankets, straw nests, and heaters in the winter. Turpentine Wildlife Refuge, 7 miles south of Eureka Springs, has been in the news recently for rescuing nearly a dozen large cats from another nonprofit sanctuary near Mountainburg, which is failing. It costs $7,000 to transport, treat, and house each new rescue. Many animals arrive sick, starving, or crippled from confinement. The refuge feeds on average 1,500 pounds of raw meat per day to the carnivores, donated by Tyson Foods, Zero Mountain, and Walmart stores. A dozen new enclosures had to be constructed this winter in a nearby valley to accommodate a surge of incoming. The nonprofit refuge annual operating budget is around $1 million a year, provided by foundations, contributions, and visitors who pay a small fee for a guided tour. None of the animals are bred or adopted. All are fortunate to live out their lives here. As for our pod painters, they're on task this winter, working towards a group exhibit this spring. After all, there's lots more cat toys to purchase.
That was just outside Eureka Springs, Turpentine Creek, earlier this... It's going to take me a month, right?
It's just, what, day two?
Oh, yeah. Yes. It takes a long time to remember.
Yes, in 2013. One of my favorite stories from 2013 is when I went to Tricycle Farms, which is in the middle of Fayetteville. But you would never know it once you get just about 10 feet in. Garland Avenue is a busy connector linking the University of Arkansas campus to Interstate 540. For more than the past year, Garland has even been louder than usual because of construction to widen the road into a boulevard. Just a few hundred feet beyond the street is a green oasis. It's a working garden called Tricycle Farms. Don Bennett is the owner.
Everyone that walks into this site just goes, how did I not know this was here? And we've kind of been calling it a field of dreams in the middle of the city or the heart of the city. It's going to give us an opportunity to really connect with people because we're right in the center and about to be connected by a boulevard, with the light, two crosswalks, a bus stop, bike trail, and brand new sidewalks.
Let's set the stage here. This plot of land, about 2 1/3 acres, is surrounded by homes on all sides. Nearby is the corner of Garland and Dean Streets, where a two-story home called the Garland House has stood since it was built more than 170 years ago. Directly to the garden's east is a rock house, Garland Avenue, and across the street, Trinity Methodist Church. Don's house is one of the homes bordering the farm, and for 25 years, he's looked out his back door to see the undeveloped land.
There have been some developers that have tried to get into this site, but there's always been this issue of access. And we were able to work that out with the owner. Tim Moldenhauer bought the house and wanted to split it off of the property. And it was exactly at the same time, I think of this as synchronicity, the same time I wanted the land but didn't want the house. And so we worked with the planning department, and Tim gave us the 50 feet on Garland. And so we now have Tricycle Farms.
Well, can we go look at?
Let's walk.
Yeah. So far, a 9,000 square foot garden with deeply contoured beds has been created. The soil, Don calls it amazing, might have been home to a previous garden decades ago. When the soil was first turned for Tricycle Farms, no rocks were found in the middle of the field. A sign it had been farmed once, or Don had somehow found just about the only spot without rocks in the Ozarks. He says his desire to buy the land dovetailed nicely with his growing knowledge of the problem of food insecurity in Northwest Arkansas. He wanted to develop a farm to help ease that problem, but he knew little about gardening, so he needed help. He decided to ask about 100 people, some selected because of their field of expertise, what was the best use for this land. It was during a small meeting with friends and advisors that another serendipitous event occurred. A fraternity occupied a nearby house and needed to fulfill some required volunteer hours. A representative from that frat dropped by the farm.
Said the thing of it is we all have to be at the same place, all of us, at the same time for at least 8 hours. And I got to thinking about that. And I thought, well, what am I going to do with 91 people? And that's really what started the ball rolling on this idea that, you know, I just have to manage. I have to be a leader of leaders. I've got to invite my friends to become leaders within this 2-acre field. And we lead larger, break the big group into smaller groups and complete multiple tasks.
In one day, that volunteer labor helped clear debris from the 2009 ice storm. About 10 to 12 cords of wood then donated to people needing heating supplies. The next day, Don says he called his friend, former Fayetteville Mayor Dan Coody, to come with his tractor and turn the soil. The adventure was on. A few months later, a Facebook request brought 60 people to the farm, and more than 700 square feet of potatoes were planted, many of them given to the church just across the street for a community meal. Don says he had developed a plan, grow food, sell 1/3 of the harvest, let another 1/3 be taken by those providing volunteer labor, and the final 1/3 could be given to community meals and food pantries. That's where the name Tricycle Farms originated.
Growing food is like printing money, you know? If you have a certain percentage of your income that is taken out for your food, well, you can actually start to address that directly and by planting a seed. And not having to go purchase that.
The plans for Tricycle Farms are not just to raise food, but to create more places like Tricycle Farms. An under-construction hoop house will be used to propagate seeds from all the plants, herbs, and food grown at the farm.
All of the plants we could ever want to grow here, and also share with other people who are needing to do a garden, because a lot of people ask me, why do you say farms instead of farm? And the idea is that we will grow farmers. And out of this site, eventually, we're on the quest to actually become obsolete here.
The range of plants is wide now and will be wider still. Edibles are planted along the edges of the farm to provide even more food. Permaculture techniques have been adopted, like planting okra, tomatoes, and peppers close to each other so the taller okra can help shade the other plants and absorb much of the summer heat. In almost every bed, there is a variety of plants.
And what that leads to is a great diversity of pollinators as well. because we're looking at butterflies, bees, bumblebees, wasps. A lot of people are scared of wasps, but they're doing a wonderful service for us.
And a sort of biodiversity of partners has developed as well. Neighbors have pitched in, and other recently developed organizations like Feed Fayetteville, Apple Seeds, and Seeds That Feed are connected. The Omni Center has provided financial stewardship to let Tricycle Farms move toward its own nonprofit status. Don Bennett says all of this started with a very simple idea, and he says there are other similar farms ready to bloom.
I think these little gems exist everywhere. I think 10 backyards or 10 front yards of a group of people that get together with the same intention, I think it's replicable anywhere. The concept is simple. It's grow food and share it. It's not even a new concept because that's what we used to do. We used to share community. We used to share meals together. We used to share the raising of barns because of some farmer's misfortune, or just the idea that if you had one thresher to handle the wheat, they used to take that from farm to farm to farm. All of the people would actually work in each farm until all of the wheat was threshed.
Because Don says he couldn't have done what Tricycle has done without help, he wants to grow the idea of one community. You can keep up with what's happening at Tricycle Farms through their Facebook page, or you can simply give Don a call at 966-0572. That back door of his that he used to use to look out at the field, that's flipped now. He says it's become his front door leading to his new life and his new quest to help people rethink food and community. This is a special edition of Ozarks at Large, some of our favorite stories from the previous 12 months. Katie Hendrickson is in the Furman Garner Performance Studio with us. Katie, what is Valley of the Vapors?
It's an independent music festival that's thriving, brings in all sorts of punk and rock bands to Hot Springs, Arkansas. And I talked to the founder, Bill Solider, who was in a seminal post-punk band in the 90s called the Blue Meanies, but he moved down to Hot Springs and he was like, there's not much going on here as far as music is concerned. So he started his own festival, and now it's a thriving independent music festival.
This tiny little festival in this tiny little town is special. And as it turns out, it's because the people that put it on are so, they're so excited about doing it once a year. And they go there an extra mile. You know, they bake cookies for the bands, and they welcome them, and they put them up in their houses. And this, like, this, like, warm embrace they give to the bands is such a surprise to the bands, you know. And it's just, and there's so many great points in the festival where these bands are just, they're just so surprised at the Hot Springs hospitality. And that's where the story really, like, rings true.
One purpose of the Valley of the Vapors Independent Music Festival and Low Key Arts is to get youth involved in the DIY culture, which is exactly what happened when Drew Martin began attending festival shows as a junior in high school. Now 20 years old, Drew booked virtually all of the bands for this year's Valley of the Vapors Festival, which takes place March 18th through 24th.
Best part really about the festival is actually putting it on, even though that week is super stressful, it's super amazing to see all the work that Bill and I and all the volunteers put into it come to fruition and create this amazing event for people to come to. And that pretty much, well, I honestly, personally, have never heard anyone say anything bad about the festival.
Just exactly how does a vibrant independent music festival end up in Hot Springs, Arkansas? Bill Solider is a veteran musician and has worked in the industry for years. He grew up in Chicago and toured all over the world in his band, the Blue Meanies, in the 1990s.
There's a little bit of a backstory. You know, I was born and raised in Chicago, and before moving to Arkansas, I had played in bands and traveled all around the world and did it professionally. And following my active music career, I went into the industry and worked for a small record label in Chicago. So I was fully immersed in music. And my partner of 21 years, Shay, and I decided to move back to our hometown, which is Hot Springs, to raise a family. And I had a job lined up, and it's beautiful here, of course. And it just became, I was withdrawing is what happened. You know, I was like going out to shows and so immersed in the Chicago music scene every day that coming to Hot Springs, there was really no underground independent music. You know, it was mostly, bar bands and blues clubs. That was about it. So I was really just kind of jonesing for some music. So I had a friend who was headed down to Austin. Her name is Nora O'Connor. And she said, "Hey, I'm going to Austin for Southwest Southwest, and I'd like to come and see you guys. Maybe you could book a show." So I booked a show for her around South by Southwest, and word got out to my friends in Chicago that I was going to put a show together, that I literally, without even trying, had booked a five-day festival back in 2005. Within 2 weeks, it was done.
This is a special edition of Ozarks at Large. We're hearing some of our favorite stories, interviews, and features from 2013. That do-it-yourself attitude that we heard in that story, it seemed to me we had a lot of stories this year about people creating things, doing things on their own, starting things. Does it seem like that to you?
I think so. I think that maybe we're in just kind of in an innovative area and innovative
right.
time.
But I also think it helps that if you see somebody do something or hear about something, maybe on the show even, hear about somebody doing something that they want to do and being successful, you're more likely to give it a go.
I think you're right. Heirloom started this year, right?
Yes. This musical duo in Fayetteville is made up of Jackson Jennings and Dana Louise Eidlett. What I like so much about this story is everybody has a unique story, but I like it when it sort of seems like the universe came together, if you will. In this particular instance, I happen to know Jackson from high school. He was one of the soccer coaches when I was there, and I happened to run into him at the University of Arkansas when he was teaching there. And more recently, when he was playing with this duo, I happened to see him at the Fayetteville Underground 1 month, and I just sort of thought it was a one-time deal. And then I saw them again and realized it was a group and they were doing stuff, so we invited them into the studio. And in talking to them, I realized that their whole meeting was happenstance as well, the first time they met before going their separate ways and then reconnecting earlier this year, or last year. Chamber inside.
sound. My feet are all calloused, walking on glass. I'm in no hurry, I've got questions to ask.
And that story first aired on Ozarks at Large in 2013. All of the stories this week are stories from the previous 12 months. We were talking about innovating and starting. Downtown Springdale. Downtown Springdale is coming back. And there was a cool art party there earlier this year connected with Mazur. But one of the new businesses on Emma, and there's some others that are coming around, is devoted to drums. And so I spent an afternoon learning about drums. This is Matt Solano at work in his store on Emma Avenue in Springdale. Matt has just opened the store, the Drum Pad, on Emma Avenue. This week, in the heat of a mid-afternoon, the air conditioner was blowing hard inside as Matt brought in a drum set from his car. He already has nearly a dozen sets, from vintage to modern, set up inside the narrow storefront. He wants the Drum Pad to become a one-stop shop for the community of local drummers, a place to hang out, maybe practice a little, and seek out important drum parts and paraphernalia.
If you go to another store, a big box store, or another large music store, you might not find something there that you can find here, and vice versa. So, I mean, I have a lot of vintage parts. I can repair vintage drums. I have, I mean, thousands of parts that I've used in the past, and they're mostly vintage drums, but I can repair modern drums and I can find parts, and I've just been around it for a long time.
This endeavor is not a knee-jerk career decision for Matt. He first took stick to drum when he was 9 years old, and he's never really lost the love for the beat. Years ago, when he lived in Oregon, he had a drum store there. He's lived in Arkansas for 8 years, and over that time, began collecting a few drum kits or parts here and there, and well, that collection never stopped growing.
And it got to be, well, this is taking over my house. You know, it was taking over. I enclosed my garage. I took that over. And then I started using the back garage. That got filled up with drum stuff. And then it started getting into the living room. And my wife was like, this is getting a little bit too much. So, you know, I mean, even if it just turns into a tax write-off, I got a place to put the stuff.
Not all drumming accessories take up much room. Matt Solano says over the past 10 years or so, vintage drums have captured the attention of a lot of people, much like vintage guitars developed into a market years before. So if a drummer is especially particular about his or her set, only the right original part will do. Matt says he has those people covered. He has small drawers filled with even smaller little bolts, nuts, and stuff.
Like here, I have a screw, you know, or even a bolt or a washer or a spring, you know, so this is an original part, you know, this is an original part. So just looking at these, I can tell, well, this is from a Ludwig drum set and what kind of lug it's from. So you might have a vintage set and you might be missing one of these. This is a claw that holds the bass drum head onto the bass drum. Well, if you need one of those to make your drum set complete, then I have that part.
like laying it down for...
Of course, not everything about a drum is small. Certainly not the sound. There are all kinds of theories about why we as a species are drawn to percussion. That it reminds us of the first sound we heard, our mother's heartbeat, or connects us to some of the earliest rhythmic sounds we might have made a few millennia ago. For Matt, there's no denying it that it's the big, booming sound that holds an attraction for him. He says it goes all the way back to his childhood in New Jersey when parades would wind through the streets. He says he would find the exact right spot to feel the boom of the marching drums.
I would want to be underneath the bridge because the drum section would go under the bridge, under the underpass of the railroad tracks on top, you know. And I would get under there and I'd feel that. Boom, 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 boom. And it would just like hit your chest, you know, and you could feel it in your stomach and everything. And it was just like, that's what I was living for. It was like, that was a high, you know. And I still feel it today when somebody comes in and you can feel the power of the bass drum hitting you in the chest.
Matt has not just drum sets for jazz or rock bands, but drums designed for marching bands as well. Four drums, for example, connected in a row that he calls quads.
And these are just tuned differently. They're tuned really tight.
The drum pad has the all-drum market cornered on Emma, a street with a rich history, but still with several empty addresses, though new antique stores, boutiques, and other businesses have opened on Emma recently. There are any number of places he could have found for his new store, but he says he was drawn to Emma Avenue in Springdale for a couple of reasons. He says the space has the sort of vintage hangout feel he thinks works perfectly for drummers, and he thinks Emma has a bright future.
What I like about downtown is that I see that it has a lot of potential coming back here. And if there's just more shops that would come down and, you know, more unique shops, we have plenty of like secondhand stores and things like that. This place could, you know, just have a little bit more foot traffic, and it's got beautiful buildings down here and stuff, and it's got a rich history. If drummers want to come here, like in the past when I had the drum shop, they'd come in and they'd tell me, hey, you know, I play this type of stick. This is the kind of stick I want. If you carry it, I'll come down. And it's just like a place to hang out. We got the taqueria up the street, and I'm going to be doing some stuff with them, with some live music, just to try to bring people down here. And I just want to kind of make it like a community where, you know, you can come here, you can go there, you can have lunch there, you can come here, you can come down here and hang out, talk about drumming.
You will be able to talk about drumming at the drum pad Tuesday through Friday from 4 until 8 p.m. and Saturdays from 11 a.m. until 6 p.m. Matt has plans to connect with instructors who may be interested in the space to teach lessons, and he has his eye or his ear focused on the space next door for possible expansion if all goes well. Before I left the drum pad on Monday, I asked if there was any particular drummer that he'd recommend listening to.
Somebody that I'm into now is Roy Haynes, and the guy's in his 80s, and he's like a kid behind the drum set. He looks very young, and he can play, and it's just something I like to see people do.
Matt Solano is the owner of the Drum Pad on Emma Avenue in downtown Springdale. That was on a program earlier this year on Ozarks at Large. Tomorrow we'll continue and conclude our week of 2013 favorites in just a moment. We're going to hear some music from the Artisphere Orchestra. That was another live broadcast KUAF did when we were at Crystal Bridges. And we did a live symphony concert.
Yes, that was amazing.
It was quite terrifying for me.
And they played part of it on performance today, too.
They did. So. They did. We'll hear that in just a moment. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. Thanks for listening.